Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A couple quick stories about the post-election new normal or new abnormal before we introduce our next guests. One is, I was listening to a sports talk show a few weeks ago, white male host with a white male caller. They talked about a few sports topics, but it was also the day after the actress Florence Henderson had died, which the caller respectfully noted with his affection for her as the mom on the Brady Bunch. And the host threw in, "Yeah, and she was a good-looking broad." Then he caught himself and said, "Oh, I guess I shouldn't use that word." And the caller replied, "Yeah, but it's the age of Trump now. It's okay." So that's one story. The other is just an email that I got because I'm all on all these political lists from the Republican strategist Roger Stone, big Trump supporter. It was right after President Obama expelled those Russian diplomats as retaliation for the election-related hacks. Subject line from Roger Stone, "Obama is a schoolgirl." And the email begins, "Patriots, I hope you had a Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah. Obama and the liberal left never ceases to amaze me how much they are disconnected from reality and act like schoolgirls. The Russian retaliation was nothing more than Obama embarrassing himself one more time before he leaves office." And the email goes on, but what struck me was the gendered message, "Obama is a schoolgirl." Cue the music. The band is the Ying Yang Twins. The song is called "Halftime, Stand Up and Get Crunk," and the genre is called crunk. And with me now are the three editors of a book called The Crunk Feminist Collection. Brittany Cooper, a co-founder of the Crunk Feminist Collective and professor of gender and Africana studies at Rutgers. Susanna Morris, another Crunk co-founder and African-American literature professor at Auburn. And Robin Boylorn, interpersonal and intercultural communication professor at the University of Alabama. They'll be doing an event at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture of the New York Public Library tomorrow night at 6:30, by the way. That's why they're all in New York from far-flung corners, at least in two of the three cases. And it's billed tomorrow night as where pop culture and politics intersect with race and gender. Professors, thanks for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll get to some of the essays in the book, but anyone want to react to either of those anecdotes as reflection of a new normal or new normalized post-election?
You know, this is why we need a revolution. There is this real serious attempt to make the kind of chicanery and ridiculousness of the Trump era reasonable and normal, and it's not. This sort of hatred of women, the hatred of immigrants, the hatred of people of color, we have to stop that. We have to stop it now. And, you know, there's also just this delusional sense on the right that Obama is the one who made all of these errors, and there's this sort of backlash, or really, as some have called it, a white lash against Obama. And I think that it's really important for us to say that each and every time, that in many cases, many of Trump's supporters are really, spiting themselves, spiting their noses, right?
And that was Professor Cooper from Rutgers.
Yeah.
Professor Morris, of all the genres in music, why Crunk Feminist Collective in particular?
Well, part of it is because of the time when we started the collective. It was in the early 2000s. Some would call that the height of crunk music. And so what we were doing was clapping back at or being confrontational or speaking truth to power in particular kinds of social moments, but also at the same time going to the club, dancing, being young people. And so we were like, you know, the phrase, "Oh, I'm getting crunk," or "I'm feeling crunk," or "I'm crunk," was going around, and we would use that to describe how we would, clap back at somebody or say, you know, what Brittany just said about, you know, the right being delusional and normalizing violent rhetoric. Well, that's getting crunk verbally. It's a rhetorical tool, right? So we use the musical term to describe our political rhetoric. So.
And I see your mission statement locates crunk as a blend of hip-hop and Southern Black culture and references mm-hmm. the South mm-hmm. as a place where many of you do important intellectual and political work. Is it just because you happen to teach at Auburn and the University of Alabama, or is there a particular intellectual or activist Southern piece, Professor Boylorn, that would be different than a Northern one?
I think so. The South definitely has a particular aesthetic and mindset around things that are happening, and they're oftentimes misunderstood, misheard, or muted when it comes to those issues. So I think that it's an opportunity for us to bring a microphone to the South, to the ways that these things are functioning in the South and that how they impact people in the South.
So it's all about Alabama today. Senator Jeff Sessions and his confirmation hearing for Attorney General,
yes.
The Crimson Tide football team losing the heartbreaker in the college football championship.
I'm not over that, yes.
and now you're here. Do you think the struggle for race and gender equality is different in qualitative ways in Alabama than in New York or at Rutgers in 2017?
Now, I do think that there's a misconception that racism lives in the South. And let's be clear that racism lives everywhere. But there are ways that it functions in the South that is different and distinct. And so people of color in the South understand race in a particular way. And the way we interact with white folk in the South is inherent in that, like it's based on those experiences that we have, whereas there's this assumed progressivism of the North where, you know, there's an assumption that, well, we're not racist, but you really are. So I think that it manifests differently, but it exists everywhere.
Absolutely. Professor Cooper, you want to pick that up?
Yeah, let's remember that Trump is from Manhattan. I mean, or Queens, as some people say. He's a New Yorker, and he has some of the most vile race rhetoric that we've seen in a couple of generations. But also, so there's a way in which Northerners, I'm from Louisiana, so it's not just that we taught in the South, but we're all from the South as well,
in some form or fashion.
And you know, there's a way in which Northerners are very polite about their racism, right? So it happens behind closed doors. In the South, people just put a Confederate flag on their truck and you sort of know where they stand. And frankly, you know, I like that, right? I don't like the Confederate flag, but I like that I know where you stand. And so that lets me know how I'm going to engage you.
Did you want to continue that point?
No, I think that that's true. As someone who's lived, I grew up in Connecticut. I've lived in the Caribbean. I've lived in South Florida. I've lived in Atlanta and Alabama. So I feel like I've run the gamut in many ways. And I completely agree. Growing up in small city, old Milltown, Connecticut, the KKK would march every year. You know, there were open displays of racism, even though I live in an integrated community and went to integrated schools. Right. So it's both. And there's no history of the United States without racism.
212-433-WNYC for these three members of the Crunk Feminist Collective, editors of the Crunk Feminist Collection, which is the book. And Betty in Manhattan wants to chime in. Betty, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if the women feel that some of that comment that you played at the top of the program, does this kind of indicate that maybe some of the misogyny that is hidden will now be brought out, and we're actually going to see what so many men are actually thinking and feeling about women? Maybe that's something that we can combat in some way.
The equivalent of the Confederate flag on the trunk, maybe a truck, maybe, Professor Cooper.
Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, we began to see it during the election season with the just sort of overt disdain for Hillary Clinton. You know, and look, it might not be the most radical feminist position, but I do think it's important to say that it is partly about misogyny and patriarchy that the woman who won, you know, the popular vote by millions of votes is not the president of the country. And so that's also rooted in a deep sort of misogyny. And just like we saw with Barack Obama, where his race created all these kinds of problems for white folks that we're living through, the prospect of a woman running the empire has created this dystopia that we're now living in, where folks would rather have this very unqualified man in charge than have one of the most qualified candidates ever that we've seen in the in the 21st century and for the better part of the 20th century running the country. And that's a problem. And so it can be about many other things. It's a more complicated story than patriarchy and race and misogyny, but it is certainly a story of patriarchy and misogyny.
Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I was telling your screener in regards to how we think about women and language. There's a game that I'm an acting teacher, and there's a game, theater game, I like to play with my students called In the Manner of the Word, where you have to ask the students to perform a task in the manner of the word, usually an adverb. And one word I always love to use is girlishly, because it really reveals what people, you know, sort of ingrained ideas about girls and women are. They'll often act very silly or skip around. Sometimes they act a little dumb. And then, you know, it always prompts a pretty interesting discussion about, you know, sort of the hidden, the ideas of misogyny that we kind of that are so embedded in us.
So when I read that Roger Stone email subject line about Obama is a schoolgirl, that triggered that thought in you about
Absolutely.
How you teach?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Let's talk about some of the essays in the book. Professor Cooper, I see one of yours is called Jesus Wasn't a Slut Shamer or How Conservative Theology Harms Black Women. Now, Jesus and slut shamer aren't words we often hear in the same sentence, even in the negative. So what's your premise?
That when we look at the story of the woman caught in adultery in the Bible, this is the story where Jesus says, you know, if any of you who is without sin cast the first stone. That's also a story about a woman who had been caught in quote-unquote sexual sins in her culture. And Jesus didn't allow these men to actually shame this woman who was getting around and getting it in. Instead, he said, you know, you need to, you know, look at your own selves and look at your own behavior, in part because clearly she wasn't getting it in by herself. Right. And so that's also a model for us when we try to think about how we can blend faith and politics. And it's particularly important in this moment where we've seen the evangelical right line up behind Trump. And so one of the things that I do at the Collective specifically is say there is a progressive, radical, feminist version of being a person of faith. And this is one of the things that it can look like.
So, Professor Boylorn, did you hear the news story in New York this week to that point about the Brooklyn Police Precinct Commander Peter Rose, who told the news site DNA Info the date rape was, quote, not an issue we're too worried about because some of them were Tinder, some of them were hookup sites, some of them were actually coworker. It's not a trend that we're too worried about because out of 13 sex attacks, only two were true stranger rapes, unquote. Now, he's apologized. But actually, I should go to you, Professor Cooper, because it relates to the idea of slut shaming.
Well, you know, it just makes me think about work that we've done at the Collective. You know, we have survivors of sexual violence as part of our community of readers and writers. And so I'm thinking specifically about the work that we all do in feminist classrooms. And Susanna can speak to some of this work around just, you know, combating sexual violence in particular ways.
Absolutely. Understanding like the definition of sexual assault, like even the term date rape is rather dated, right? I mean, pun intended. The whole notion of that you go on a date with someone versus stranger rape, right? Understanding that many sexual assaults, in fact, most sexual assaults happen with someone that you know, right? That intimate partner violence, sexual assault, physical assault, that these are things that are not like some boogeyman in a dark alley with a trench coat and nothing else on. You know, that's how we sort of imagine violence of all sorts, whether it's rape or child abuse or even racism. We imagine a kind of boogeyman somewhere, but it's actually much closer to home, and that's much more scary. And if we can own up to that, going back to the parable with Jesus, right? It's actually in our community. This woman cannot sin alone, right? So these sins of sexual violence are sins of our community that we actually can be accomplices to, right? By not actually using the right terminology, by not holding people accountable and so on. If our actual officials, our police officials who are supposed to keep us safe, don't have the right language, then we're doomed.
I think Thomas in Brooklyn wants to push back on the idea that it's good if our racism and sexism surface. Thomas, do I have that right?
Yes, I've heard that argument a number of times. And, you know, the first time I heard it, it made me think twice because I sort of agreed with it. But that's just, I don't think that's the case the more time that I've spent thinking about it. I think it's important to acknowledge that for generations we've fought to keep this from the surface of society, and we've fought to, you know, create this culture where people have to hide their Confederate flags, people have to hide these racist and misogynist tendencies. And I think that's actually the best tactic we can hope for and the best we can take. And I think we should be working to sort of push this from the front of society and push it down until we kill it, basically.
It's racism shaming compared to what we were talking about before as maybe a good thing. Professor Boylan, right. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that the ways that racism hides and how sometimes that makes us feel better because it's not, you know, explicit. It's more covert. And in some ways, that's okay, you know, because I tell my students that, you know, it's 2016, now 17. It's not okay to wear your KKK T-shirt to class. But I still need to know if that's your mindset. I need to know how you're thinking about race politics. I need to know whether or not you have problematic, you know, ideas about race and ethnicity. And I can't know that if you're hiding it. I can't teach you to think differently if you're pretending to think differently than you actually do. So I think that you know, and it feels more dangerous. This feels like a more dangerous moment, this Trump moment, because racists feel emboldened to express that hate. Yeah. And I think that in the academy, at least, many times we get used to people hiding it. And that makes us feel more safe. So we know they're not quite right, but it's not in our face. So I think that there has to be a happy medium. While I'm not trying to have to encounter daily that daily assault of blatant racism on my way to work, when I get in my classroom, I need students who have been conditioned to hide it, to expose it a little bit so that I can combat it through education.
Let me ask you all about feminism and the election. Earlier in the show, we talked to Emily Bazelon from the New York Times Magazine, and she wrote an article on white college-educated women who voted for Trump, which was 45% white college-educated women. And one who she wrote about from Pennsylvania named Palma Frabel, self-employed as a marketing consultant, has a degree in the equivalent of graphic design from the Art Institute of Philadelphia and another in small business administration. She has adult daughters, apparently. And this says, Frabel also admires Ivanka Trump and felt she was one of the campaign's top three assets. She sees Ivanka as a role model for Abigail, I think that's her daughter, in her own entrepreneurial interests. It's not Hillary's Gloria Steinem feminism, as Frabel put it, that she values. It's Ivanka's sleek version of female success, which commentators have labeled commodity feminism, branding to sell products. But she said, I've been paid the same as men. I've managed men. I've not had any trouble working with men. And Emily Bazelon concludes, for Trump supporters that I talk to, college education didn't seem to lead to support for the liberal women's movement. So, Professor Morris, maybe you want this. I'm just curious about your reaction to that. And since 45% of white college-educated women voted for Trump, the idea of college not translating for that many women into what that source called Hillary's Gloria Steinem feminism.
Mm-hmm. I think there are a couple of things happening here. One, I think there's a disconnect. I don't like to necessarily use the second wave, third wave rhetoric and so on, but I do think it might be helpful in this instance. So I think that there's sometimes a disconnect intergenerationally between folks of the second wave and folks of the third wave. This person sounds like she has adult children, but she could be a Gen Xer, you know. So I think some of the strides that were made in the 70s and so on, they seem distant. They seem far away. It seems like that's old hat and we don't have to struggle in that same way. I work with men. It's fine and so on. Right. I think the other point to be made here, too, is that this is why intersectionality matters. This is why looking at not just gender inequity, but racism and classism and so on and other systems of power are important, because for some white women, I think that 45% who voted for Trump, the one thing that they needed to make themselves fine was to get rid of patriarchy or sexism. Once they felt like it was over, then they're good, right? And the rest of us are like, well, I'm over here battling homophobia, transphobia, ableism, and so on. Like, I have a lot to be before I can even, like, get to the top, right? And if the one thing between you and making it is, you know, somebody with, you know, calling somebody abroad or something, and you're like, I can overlook that, you know? So I think that there's a way in which a narrow focus on sort of patriarchy and this, you know, very superficial elimination of it that has some people just willing to look at, oh, Ivanka's smart. She's a great bag and she's super rich.
Her bags are fly.
Her bags are amazing, but you can be fly and have good politics.
All right. We're out of time, except to say, Professor Borland, maybe you want to do this. What can people expect if they come see you at the Schomburg tomorrow night?
A crunk conversation.
Fair enough, which would only to be expected from the Crunk Feminist Collection. Our three guests, co-editors of the Crunk. Okay, I blew the whole thing.
It's a tongue twister.
It's a Crunk Feminist Collective that will be appearing tomorrow. The book is the Crunk Feminist Collection. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll play some highlights from the Jeff Sessions confirmation hearing so far, which has been going on in Washington. Stay with us.